Great trial lawyers are made, not born. Welcome to Verdict Academy, preserving trial wisdom for trial lawyers. Join host Kevin Morrison, trial attorney in San Francisco, as he recreates those invaluable hallway conversations that remote work has made rare. Candid insights and hard-won lessons from America's most accomplished trial lawyers. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Welcome to another episode of Verdict Academy, where we bring you the best trial lawyers in the country to share their top three trial tips. My name is Kevin Morris, and I'm in San Francisco. And today, my guest is Craig Peters, who's also in San Francisco. He's my friend, and he's my law partner. Craig was raised in the Bay Area. He went to UCSD and then on to USF Law School. After graduation, he went to work as a public defender, first in Contra Costa County and then San Francisco. By the end of his time in San Francisco, he was training other lawyers on trial techniques. Craig then decided to leave criminal practice and went to work at a plaintiff's firm specializing in asbestos cases, where he was their trial attorney. After some time there, he got into non-asbestos personal injury and wrongful death cases working at Bill Veen's office, where he immediately achieved great success in trying a variety of cases, including products, trucking, and pretty much every form of serious personal injury or wrongful death cases. For the last 8 years, along with me and some other folks, he founded Altair Law in San Francisco, where he's continued to try cases on behalf of what Craig likes to describe as the underdog. He's had remarkable success, including helping to obtain a $40 million verdict for non-economic damages only for a plaintiff with serious back injuries, but not a spinal cord injury, not a brain injury, and verdicts for three African-American women totaling over $8 million in federal court for essentially being detained in a parking lot for an hour, driving while black. When Craig's not trying cases, he's mentoring others, including as a faculty member at the Aboda Trial College. Craig is a member of the Big Four invitation-only organizations, ACTL, ISOB, Aboda, and the International Academy of Trial Lawyers. He's next year's president of the Academy and has also served as president of the Consumer Attorneys of California. I can tell you that Craig is one of the most creative people I know, always has great ideas, and quickly can distill a case into its overall meaning from the 36,000-foot view. He does not get lost in the weeds. He is adept at keeping it simple. Craig, welcome to Verdict Academy.
Thanks, Kevin. That was a really nice intro. Feels like maybe that's a little much. I don't know. But thank you. Nice.
Actually, I feel about you, so I didn't even have to research. Just knew that from heart. I also know that you're one of the top two favorite children of your mother.
I am. I'm definitely in the top two running, I think.
I think so.
I mean, if you exclude grandkids and dogs, I definitely make the top two.
Some kids. Yeah. As you know, Craig, the format of the show is three trial tips from the top trial lawyers. You're certainly among the top trial lawyers in the country, but I do like to ask an icebreaker question. I'm curious. I know I knew this at one point, but I forgot. Why did you decide to leave criminal law and get into civil law?
You know, I think I was having a little bit of a midlife crisis. You know, I had done criminal law for so long and I'd tried every kind of case. I'd worked on every kind of case there was. I had been the director of training, as you mentioned. I'd been doing that for, I think, just over 3 years at that point. And I was kind of ready to either go back into the line and manage my own caseload again or maybe try something else. But I was kind of asunder. I wasn't really sure what to do. And I think if you're male having a midlife crisis, you either, you know, go find a young woman to run around with, you go get a sports car, or you change jobs. And I like my wife, I'm not big into cars, so it seemed like change jobs was the good option. And it just had so happened that I had gotten a call from that firm that you mentioned that did mesothelioma asbestos cases, and they had asked me to come work for them. And I had said, no thanks, but no thanks, I'm pretty happy. And the urging of Maureen, I gave them a call back, said, hey, is that job still available? Maybe we should talk. And we did. And here I am many years later. I'm not sure how long. I really at the time thought it would be a very short, you know, stint, kind of an expose into some other field, sort of see what that was like and then go back. I really loved being a public defender. So nobody was more surprised than me that I'm still here doing this.
Yeah, not a lot of people spend significant time doing criminal work and then spend significant time doing civil work. It's unusual. Well, you succeeded in both areas, so it's amazing. The three tips you want to give generally in the area of objections or lack thereof, three things from a witness, and then non-economic damages and subtopics within that. So let's start with the first, objections or lack thereof. Craig, what do you want to share with our audience about objections?
Yeah, and I want to say, Kevin, you're doing great podcasts. I think these are super helpful. And watching them, I was trying to find some things that maybe hadn't been covered yet. So hopefully these fit that bill. You know, I think from, again, sort of 30,000 feet, you know, a trial is all about credibility. It tends to be less about facts. It tends to be about who the jury feels like they can trust. And so I want that case to go as quickly and as smoothly as possible. I want them to start to notice things about me that maybe make me different from the other side. And so as it relates to objections, I really try to work hard and, you know, depending on who's on the other side of the case and depending on the judge, it can be challenging, but I try to work very hard to build a relationship with the other side, with the defense, and be upfront with them about what's going to happen in my case and give them a heads up in the hopes that they will reciprocate. So, you know, for instance, as soon as I know when a witness is going to be on the stand, I let the other side know. If it's 5 days from now, 3 days from now, whatever, I just let the other side know. I don't think that there's those games of holding back and not letting them know until the last minute. I don't think that serves either side very well. It certainly doesn't serve the jury well. And I think it builds some credibility with counsel on the other side. And in doing so, I'm then hopeful that we'll have clarity about what is coming in and what isn't so that I can avoid objecting. I want to object as little as possible. And I have had trials where I have not objected once during the trial. Again, kind of depends on the counsel I have on the other side. And again, depends on the judge. I have found in some cases where I have attempted to do this, sort of not do the objecting, there's things I've needed to object to. A technique that I found is successful is to let the judge know that my general manner in trial is to not object. And the only time I'm going to do it is if it's something really important. And so I may not give the basis for the objection up front. I may ask for a sidebar because I want to talk to the judge because usually it's something really significant. And judges, generally speaking, I've found appreciate that. Counsel appreciates that as well. Some will take advantage of me declaring that my intention is not to object, but I have found that that has been the small minority. Again, I think you're mirroring what you want. And so if you're being forthright and honest with the other side about what you intend to do, more often than not, you'll get that back from the other side. And then what I have found is in many cases, sometimes on the other side, particularly because they have resources and systems that are different from the plaintiff side on the defense side, you know, they'll maybe have a appellate attorney that's working on the other side or some other counsel who's supervising or watching. That drives behavior differently, I think. And so sometimes they'll feel compelled to object because somebody's telling them they have to. And so there's the dichotomy I'm looking for is, generally speaking, once we've gotten past motions in limine, we know what the field looks like, if you will. I'm going to be okay with all that stuff because those are the rulings the judge has made. That's the playing field. I'm going to hope that this jury is going to take all that information and still find in the right way for my client. So that's kind of a general philosophy. And I find that if you, again, trials are so complicated. There's so many weeds and minutiae to get involved in. I like to have things that are sort of kind of like what you mentioned. I like to sort of try to think every morning as I'm going into trial from 30,000 feet, what I'm generally trying to accomplish, because that will ultimately dictate the behavior that I have during trial and trying to create that dichotomy for the jury that hopefully ends up with them trusting me more.
I definitely share that philosophy, and I think objections tend to draw attention to whatever is going on because attention spans are shorter and shorter. And I can tell you, as someone as a juror, you flat out bored. I'm like, oh, objection, I need to pay attention now. I was just thinking about my dry cleaning, but what's going on? That's one of the things I think it draws attention to whatever's happening. There are moments, of course, Craig, there's an exception to every rule, right? Where it's a significant misstep. It's a violation of an order, or it's just really grievous and you need to put something on the record. Is it your strategy that puts the objection on the record, ask for a sidebar and hash it out? Is that generally what you do?
Yeah, I know you just recently experienced this, which is always really disappointing, right? Like there's advocates on both sides on each case, right? And we expect them to fight hard for their client, just like I'm sure they expect us to fight hard for our client. But you know, the rules should matter, and sounds quaint maybe, but honor should matter and doing things the right way should matter. And when they don't, it's so disappointing, right? Because it feels like not only a violation of trust for you as the person who's had this horrible thing happen, but it sort of feels like it degrades the system in some way too. So yes, when that happens, and that's happened to me as well, I think it's probably happened to every trial lawyer. My general approach is I want to go do a sidebar with the judge. And I think you're right. What objections do is they generally call attention. They kind of wake up the jury. You don't have to go any further than turning on YouTube, or if people still watch news, look at the news. The news is bad. There's conflict. When there's conflict, people pay attention. What is an objection? It's conflict. As opposed to sort of that thing just going along and there's no conflict from you, it tends to make it less impactful at times. But again, I think you're right. There's certainly going to be occasions where you have to object.
It does take a while to get out of the issue spotting lawyer, like, oh, that's a technical objection. It's a correct technical objection, but who cares? So it takes a while to get out of the issue spotting to say, you know what? Who cares? It takes a while for that, but we want to make sure that folks understand when they're starting to try cases, just because there's an objection that should be sustained doesn't mean you have to make it.
And similarly, just because you have a good fact doesn't mean you have to put in that good fact, right? Like, again, jurors, they're like all the rest of us. They can only take in so much. And so I think there's a real value in picking the facts that you think are the most important and giving them just those, or at least spending most of your time on those so that those are the things they remember.
Well, great transition. The three strings from a witness. I think you and I share the rule of three, the love for the rule of three. I know we do. Tell me about your thoughts on three things from a witness.
Yeah, and this actually came from way back in my public defender days, where we were pretty under-resourced for the first half of my career. And then thanks to Jeff Adachi and his innovative ways, you know, we became better resourced. We could have experts and sometimes even multiple experts, people to help us with graphics, that sort of thing. But early on, what I was doing, and it was in part because I think I'm a visual learner, but it was also in part because it helped me make sense of the case, is that I would essentially storyboard my case with very terrible hand-drawn drawings that I made. I'm not an artist. And I would then try to figure out who in the case could testify to each of those pictures, right? And the goal was, you could look at this row or couple of rows of pictures and you could generally understand the case. That's now morphed and transitioned a bit. And now I do it a little bit in reverse. And I think about, you know, I always start with the verdict form. From the verdict form, I go to closing argument. Once I've got my closing argument and the verdict form done, now I know here are the things I got to get in. And so with each witness, presumably I've already got them linked to those things. And I want to figure out for each witness, what are the three things max? It can, by the way, it can be one. In fact, I love the one thing witness. But max three things that they are going to give to this jury. And then how do we get those things to the jury in a way that has a visual representation? I think it's important for two reasons. One is, most of us who have tried cases and read about, you know, all these amazing books that are out there about trying cases, people remember things at a far greater rate when they hear it and they see it than if they just hear it. So that's a good reason to have a visual to go with the testimony. But the second, and I think more important reason, is because we forget that a great closing argument will frequently not win a case unless it's done one important thing, which is give to your good jurors, presumably you've got at least one, hopefully more, the arguments that they need to make when they go back in that jury room to get the other jurors to come to their side. And my experience has been the best way to do that is with those visual aids, because those are links back to the testimony they heard. And so I can use those graphics with the jury to remind them when somebody back there says X, Y, and Z, you remind them that it's actually A, B, and C. And remember, we heard it and we saw it. And here are the three documents that support that. And they didn't have anything to contradict it, you know, whatever the argument might be. So I have lots of particularly expert witnesses who resist this. They either don't want any or they want 50. And I think that's a really important thing that I learned as well.
Visual aids you're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay.
Again, when I was a public defender, we rarely got experts. And then when we did, it was such a treat that you really curated that expert. And so we basically would say, this is what you're going to do. And they, you know, there was kind of no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And so when I came into the plaintiff's world, one of the things I noticed was a lot of experts, the relationship seems to work the other way frequently, where the expert's telling the plaintiff's attorney, and I imagine probably same with defense attorneys, here's how I'm going to do this. It's like, no, you have your opinions. Those opinions are helpful to me. Here's how I'm going to get that information to the jury in a way that's most effective. And if they're not on board with that, then I go find myself another expert. But I think that that's really getting witnesses to narrow down and think critically about what are the most important points they're making and how does it help move the ball forward as it relates to the verdict form. Because at the end of the day, those are the only questions, those are the only answers that matter, right? Are those questions. So, and there's, of course, exceptions to this, like every rule with a life care planner. If I've got an econs case, I want to put the whole life care plan in. That's obviously going to be more than 3 pages. It's a single document, arguably, but there's some wiggle room here. But I caution people that don't think that everything gets wiggle room, because then pretty soon the rule's gone. At least for me, it has importance in terms of simplifying the case.
Yeah, let me just kind of put a little meat on those bones, as they say. I saw what you did when we tried the Allied case, the mass shooting case. We had a security expert who we kind of set the case up through that expert. And this is also true for doctors who are kind of notorious. You know, doctors or orthopedic surgeons, for example, are quite confident in their abilities to do things, including surgery and their ability to explain things. And this is how they're going to do it, period. And let me show you what I'm going to show the jury. And you have to have the guts, the courage, and presence to say, you know what, I appreciated, noted, that's not how it's going to happen here. And this is what I'm going to show you. And this is what we're going to show through you. And you have to work with that expert to make sure he or she understands, buys into the graphic, make it simple, and does it on the way that you want to do it. And I know that takes enormous amount of time. I saw how much time it took you with our expert in security case. It can take many, many hours, many, many sessions, but it's necessary. And it's just a lot of advance work, right?
You know, my grandfather on my dad's side was a painter, and he told me something that has stuck with me my whole life, particularly as a lawyer, which is the key to painting is prep. It's all about prep. Painting's actually really easy. If you do a lousy prep job, you will have terrible painting. But if you spend the time and you're diligent and conscientious about the prep work, even the things that you'd really rather not have to do, you know, doing the edging, doing the filling in with plaster, if you're willing to do that work, then by the time you get to the painting, it's easy. It's the same way with trial and our experts, every witness, right? It's you got to put in, I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've spent hours and hours and hours with a witness and I put them on the stand for 15 minutes. But that's also, I think, in some ways, that's the fun part of our cases, is that we get to learn about people. We're investigators, ultimately. That's really a big part of the job, is being a good investigator, being curious and inquisitive and learning how to ask good questions, not trial cross-exam questions, but more kind of open-ended questions, and building a relationship with people so they feel comfortable, you know, giving you that info. And I think that's true with experts as well.
Yeah. How does the jury help to understand this, right? You're always phrasing it in such a way as, in order to help the jury do its job, how do we best explain this to them? You're going with that mindset, that's really important. But boy, you can't shortcut it. You can't be doing this 2 days before the expert takes the stand or 2 days before his deposition, because it's going to go real bad if you wait that long.
Agreed. And the attendant benefit that maybe should be the primary benefit when we think about this is that when you workshop and workshop and workshop and get it down to its simplest element, and you've got these good graphics, you can then turn around and you can use those with the defense witnesses. I had a case in Monterey where there was a neurosurgeon. He's the neurosurgeon who worked on the poor guy who got beat up at the ballpark.
Brian Stowe.
Brian Stowe, yeah. I think his name was...
Is it UCSF? Is that the guy, UCSF?
Yeah, UCSF.
I forgot his name. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Really smart guy, really good witness, really tough witness. But I had created a checklist for my own expert. And as he was testifying, I was like, hey, wait a minute. I can use that same checklist with him, and he's going to have to agree with me, which... You know, the issue was whether this roll down a mountainside and a caterpillar bulldozer had, why had my decedent died as a result of that? We said it's because his head had smacked into one of the pillars. And they said, no, it's because of the centrifugal forces of rolling down that caused serious brain injury. And so we had a checklist of, you know, well, which things here would have been caused by centrifugal forces and which things by smacking your head into one of these solid steel pillars. And of course, the last one was this giant gash that opened the poor decedent's head, and he had to agree. Yeah, that was just the B pillar. So,
all right, last point, non-economic damages. How do you set the table? What kind of witnesses do you call? Talk to us about non-econs, Craig.
Yeah, and this, I just referred to or alluded to this earlier. I love the one topic witness. I've said many times in some of the talks that I will give about trial testimony and trying cases generally, that, you know, you really want to spend time with your client, because in doing so, where they live, spending time with them where they are spending their time when you're not around, that's where you want to be, because that is where you will frequently find some real gold in terms of witnesses who can talk about the changes to your client. And my favorite example of this was a client that I had just outside of Fresno in the Central Valley. And I met him at his house with his wife and his kids. It was near lunchtime. They said, hey, do you want to get lunch? I said, yeah, that'd be great. Let's go get lunch. And they said, well, there's a great taqueria around the corner that we like to go to. Fantastic. So we walked there. And as we walked a block and a half to this kind of main street and we made a right, we went around the corner of this kind of bodega corner store place. And my client kind of nodded his head inside to the guy at the counter, and the guy inside waved, and we kept walking. I said, you know, do you know that guy? He goes, oh, no, you just, I get need to pick groceries up or something. Last minute, I go there. And I said, okay. I said, do you know his name? He's like, ah, it's, I can't remember. You know, he was sort of struggling. I said, oh, okay, no big deal. So anyhow, we have lunch. We go back to his house. I spent maybe 6-ish hours with him. It was late in the afternoon. I was getting ready to get back to my car. I thought, you know, I'm going to go back to that corner liquor store and talk to that guy and see what he knows about my client. So I went in and said, hey, I'm a lawyer, represent my client. Have you noticed any changes to him? He goes, oh, yeah. When he come in, he was always happy. He was really upbeat. He usually had one of his kids hanging on him. You know, he loved being out with his kids. And for the last, you know, year and a half, 2 years, something's different. He just doesn't seem the same. You know, I notice physical differences, but there's something different just about his face. Like I don't see him smile very much. And I asked him, do you know his name? And he's the same thing. He was struggling. He's like, ah, I think it's, you know, he made some guesses. I said, that's okay. I said, hey, if I needed you to come talk to a jury about what you just told me, would you be willing to do that? He goes, oh, I don't know, it's really busy. And he gave me all the excuses. Anyhow, long story short, he ended up agreeing. I went back and saw him again. And he was just an amazing witness, right? Because what does the other side do with that witness? The guy doesn't even know my guy's name. He knows him by face, but doesn't really know his name. But he can talk about the differences. So I also, you know, I think when we're building our case and talking about the losses our clients have experienced, you want as 360 investigation as possible, all sides. It's not just, you know, aunts and uncles and brothers and sisters and spouses and kids, super close friends, but the larger community, you know, if they go to a church or a temple or a mosque, if they play pickleball, you know, if they pick their mail up someplace. I used to be, and I had this in one of my cases when I was doing criminal defense work, called a mailman in who used to see my client all the time, right? So being with them where they live really helps you get a better sense of who they may be interacting with, which then can lead you to those folks who might give you great testimony. So I think that's the piece that's really important on top of all the other pieces, the people that we, I'm sure, all could think of. Then the question becomes, well, now what is the number? And what I have done recently, the case that you mentioned in Hayward, where the client was, you know, compensated $40 million, the way we decided to approach that was we're going to figure out what we think the value of the deficits are on a yearly basis. And we're going to do that by looking at what do we pay for joy, right? And so we look at whatever, Steph Curry's, Shohei Ohtani's, the Jennifer Aniston's, like people, right? People that everybody knows that are out there in the public that get paid good money to bring joy. Now, granted, there is an economic piece to that, but what's driving it is joy. So now the scale has to be equal, right? I mean, my dad used to say, you're going to have rough times. Just remember those rough times are going to help you feel joy to the same extent on the other end of the spectrum because you've had those tough times. And so it's still going to be hard and nobody likes hard times, but they're a really important part of being human and being able to experience the full spectrum of emotion. And so talking to a jury about that and saying it has to be that we have to compensate for those losses that make our lives worse in the same way that we would compensate for joy. And so if we think about it as a job with a job description, and now here is my client's new reality. You said, I'm going to pay that person, I'm going to offer them $1 million a year to have this current condition. Or alternatively, say you don't get the $1 million a year and you can have your old health back. Which one would they take? Well, of course, they'd say, you can keep your million, give me my health. What does that tell us? It tells us that $1 million a year is a reasonable number. I'm pulling a number out just randomly now for purposes of hoping people can understand where I'm headed here. But now you've got your base number. You let the jury know, look, the reason you're here by and large, yeah, they may be fighting me on liability or causation, but not really. At the end of the day, really why we're here is because they don't want to pay for the full value of what my clients lost. So that's your job, is to figure out what those losses are. What we know is the floor is $1 million a year. Now you can decide this however you want. You can think about my client's future life in chapters, you know, the next 10 years versus the last 10 years versus the preceding 4 years. You can go year by year. You can think about when my client's not going to be able to walk his daughter down the aisle when she gets married and what that's going to feel like. You can pick. But that's your job when you go back there, is for all of you to figure out what the right number is. That's between one and whatever you think the cap is. You know, maybe it's $7 million a year. And I think that this does a couple of things. One, it helps drive home this point that losses need to be valued commensurate with what they have actually taken from people's lives. That's preventing the kind of joy people would otherwise have. But two, it gives the jury a job. And I think while we want to make it easy for the jury, they want to figure something out. And so this gives them something to figure out that's perhaps the most important and meaningful decision they're going to make of all the questions on the verdict form. So I like it for that reason, because it feels like I'm helping to empower them to make this really important decision. So that's kind of my approach. Every time it's slightly different, but that's generally from sort of 30,000 feet how I approach it.
Great advice. Well, unsurprisingly, the 30 minutes has flown by, but I do want to give a last opportunity to, you know, give any parting words for folks who are struggling with the concept of being a trial lawyer, or think it's too hard, or what advice do you want to give to our audience, Craig?
So I think being a trial lawyer is hard. I think being a litigating attorney is really hard too, in some ways even harder. For those of us who try a lot of cases, you know, there's this frenetic period right before trial and then during trial. And that's really hard. It's, you know, not great sleep and probably not great nutrition and, you know, lots of things that aren't going the way we normally would have them go in the rest of our life. But the folks who actually, you know, litigate a case and fight with the other side to get the information they need and all of that stuff, that's really hard too. It's a different kind of hard. And I think that it's really important that people figure out what feels right for them. I don't think people should feel compelled to be a trial lawyer because they have some perception of what that means. Trial lawyers are no better or more important than really good litigating attorneys, in my mind. And that's because I'm not that good at litigating cases. I don't like those fights and it's exhausting. And I would much rather take the kind of exhaustion that I get from being a trial lawyer. So I think thinking about that and being really intentional about what role, what piece you want to play in somebody's case really will lead to greater happiness. I know it has for me. It always makes me sad when I hear about, you know, the level of discontent amongst lawyers with their job, because I feel like I've got like one of the greatest jobs on earth. But it's great for me because it fits my personality. And so I just feel like if people could really think about that piece, I think that that would lead to more happiness. And I think anybody can be a trial lawyer that wants to, so long as they go in with eyes wide open, recognizing what those challenges are compared against the challenges of some other piece of the litigation process. So I don't know if those were words of wisdom, but that's...
They are for sure. You got to, you know, life is short. You got to love what you do, right? So if it's trial law, that's great. It's what I love. It's what you love. But if it's not, do something you love, because who knows how long we're here, right?
Yes, as my dad used to say, all of our stories end badly, which was not actually negative. It was just saying like, look, it's, you know, forget like it is going to end someday. And so take advantage of the time you got.
Yeah.
But nobody's getting out alive.
No one here gets out alive, as Jim Morrison said, right? Yeah. Craig Peters, it's been a delight. Thanks for being a guest on Verdict Academy.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Verdict Academy. If today's insights resonated with you, please subscribe and share with colleagues. In a world where we see each other less, learning from experienced trial lawyers matters now more than ever. Join us next time. Produced and powered by Law Pods.